We present a report from London by John Steele, Mutual's American representative in England. European broadcasts are subject to censorship at the point of origin. The next voice you hear will be that of John Steele.
Good evening. London is still enduring its purgatory, and at the moment there's no sign of any let-up, but rather of an intensification of the bombing, which now keeps Londoners on the alert all round the clock. Hitler's air tactics change from day to day, so it's difficult to draw any very clear picture of what is happening, or at any rate, any picture which will be accurate a day or so later. He began with mass daylight raids on the British Empire capital, in which hundreds of planes took part. But he soon found out that the Royal Air Force was able to deal with them, and that one in four, at least, of his planes never got home. Then he tried nuisance raids at night, just a few planes at a time. And for a few days he got away with that. Then the British countered that with a gun barrage. Nothing like it has ever been seen or heard before. Thousands of guns all round London keep up a continuous fire, throwing up a curtain of steel which the raider must either penetrate or climb over. They can't penetrate it, and climbing destroys any pretense of accurate bombing and forces the raiders, whether they wish it or not, to drop their cargo indiscriminately. It is true that they've been able to concentrate on the West End and the center of the city, but only in a general way. And while they have done heavy damage, they have missed everything of military importance, sometimes by miles, sometimes by narrower margins. Then on Sunday last, tactics were changed again, and it was a bad day for Hitler and a grand day for the Royal Air Force. Between 300 and 400 German planes came over, and 189 of them remained. The countryside from the Kent coast to London and the city streets were strewn with wrecked German aircraft. The young pilots of the RAF fought them on the coast, fought them in the country, and fought them over London. I had occasion on that day to drive to the south coast, about 40 miles from London. All seemed quiet, both there and on the road. But on the way home, we passed truck after truck, each carrying the wreck of a German plane. They had been collected and were being taken to a breaking-up dump preparatory to being melted down to make British Spitfires and Hurricanes. Perhaps it'll give you some idea of how local the effects of these raids are when I tell you that the sight of these wrecks was all that we saw or heard to indicate that the greatest air battle of all time to date was being fought more or less over our heads. Damage has been done, and heavy damage, but the life of London has been much less interrupted than one would expect. Traffic has been disorganized, of course. Your taxicab driver takes you by strange, roundabout routes. Now and then you see a street roped off where there's a dangerous building, or perhaps a time bomb buried in the street. Some of the railway stations are temporarily out of use, but never for long. You're not quite sure what train you catch, and if you do catch it, whether it's the one you wanted or not, but they all do get there, even if a bit late. The worst dislocation and suffering have been caused in the working-class districts of the East End, where whole streets of little houses have been bombed to smithereens. At first, there was a near scandal over the failure to provide proper alternative accommodation for these people. Hundreds of them were crowded into empty schools and churches, and the arrangements for sanitation and feeding were rather primitive. This was not due to any failure by the authorities to appreciate their plight, but to the curious political organization of London, which consists not of one unitary city, but of nearly 100 separate municipalities. The local authorities in the bombed areas did the best they could with the accommodation at their command. But all this has been solved now by the intervention of the national government, which called on the richer boroughs and safer districts to throw open their accommodation, with an implied threat that if they didn't, the national government would take charge itself. The threat was not really necessary, for all that was wanted was guidance. Now great houses, which have been standing empty in the western districts, have been commandeered for refugees, and in some districts, billeting has been introduced. Arrangements for the transport of the homeless to new homes are working well. Another problem which has not yet been solved is that of the air raid shelters. In some districts, they're better than others. Early in the evening now, one can see little streams of people. Father, mother, and the children trekking to the better all they know of some distance away. They take camp chairs, rugs, and even mattresses and settle down for the night, sometimes to the exclusion of local residents for whom the shelters have been built. There have been complaints, of course, but it has all been good-natured so far, and the authorities are now working on a plan to distribute the shelter space safely and equitably. Then there's the problem of the tubes. These are London's underground railways. They're deep in the subsoil under London and as safe from bombing as anything can be. You can gain entrance to them by buying a 4-cent ticket to the next station, and apparently you cannot be made to board a train. Thousands have found this out and are camping in the tubes during the night alarm period, which now runs from dusk to dawn. It all sounds very terrible, but it's all taken with good humor and Cockney spirit. In the morning, mother and the children go home to their little house, and father goes to work. There's no panic, no wild rush for safety, and I was going to say no fear. But of course there is fear. No one can hear the roar of the barrage, the crash of bombs, and all the other terrible noises of the night without being upset. But the Londoner has that true courage which overcomes fear and makes him carry on with his job. At the other end of the social scale, we have the example of Parliament. It met yesterday while raiders were trying to reach London. It transacted its business and decided to keep on meeting whatever happened, but only not to announce the dates and times of meeting. That would be making a present of information which they would dearly like to have to the Germans. And during that meeting, the Prime Minister, who in himself personifies British courage, gave a review of the war and of its prospects, and promised to keep Parliament informed of its progress. He paid high tribute to the courage of his people, as well as to that of the sailors, soldiers, and airmen, and he made special reference to the gallantry of the police, firemen, first aid workers, and other civil auxiliaries, who are as truly in the front line as any soldier. But there's one small section of Britain's defenders who deserve special mention. They're a suicide squad of Royal Engineers, whose duty it is to deal with time bombs that the Germans are dropping in large numbers. These bombs bury themselves in the ground and may not go off for 2 or 3 days. It's the duty of this squad to dig them out and render them harmless. Their greatest exploit, of course, is the digging out of a time bomb weighing a ton, which fell just beside the wall of St. Paul's Cathedral and would have destroyed the cathedral had it not been dug out with engineers who took 3 days at the task. When the finally exploded in a marsh near London, it blew out a crater 100 feet deep. In the meantime, the Navy and Army wait for the invasion. No one knows when it's coming or whether it's coming. There's ample evidence that Hitler has been assembling troops and ships and otherwise preparing it for weeks. But as in Queen Elizabeth's day, when God sent his winds and scattered the Spanish Armada, he has sent them again during the last 2 or 3 days and scattered the barges and ships assembled across the channel to bring Hitler's hordes to Britain. The RAF also did a bit of scattering, and yesterday it was busy nosing out the holes and corners in which the German would-be invaders have taken refuge. Of course, no one can tell how long the present weather conditions will last, but while they do, any attempt at invasion would seem to be suicidal. A gale is not good for towing strings of heavily laden barges over from 20 to 100 miles of sea. But the weather's not all on Britain's side. It has checked the nightly raids on Berlin, while not having the same effect on the German raids on England, which are made from fields in France and Belgium, near the coast. Now a word about the casualties. You'll remember that last week I warned you to look at them, awful as they are, in proportion. The Prime Minister told us yesterday that in the first 2 weeks of this month, 2,000 civilians had been killed and 8,000 wounded by German raiders, of whom 4/5 were in what is vaguely known as the London area. Well, as I told you last week, there are still some 9 million people carrying on in the London area and some 45 million in Britain. Thank you and good night.